Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Welcome to Bristol's first podcast, Dialect, which goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. Victims of miscarriages of justice are growing, in part due, of course, to the extinction of investigative TV documentaries such as the BBC's Rough Justice. But fear not. To the rescue, Victims Unite and editor Sabine McNeil. And also this week we're joined by another person that features on Victims Unite, that's Maurice Kirk. So let's start, ladies first, with our guest on the phone. That's Sabine McNeil. Hi, Sabine. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony.
Now, I notice you've got a post on your blog this week, that is at victims-unite.net, today about the abolition of the ban on recording court proceedings. Now, as far as I know, you're actually not allowed to record anything in court. Is that the case?
Yes, if you do, you will be imprisoned for contempt of court. There's a Contempt of Court Act that doesn't allow people to do either audio or video recordings.
Okay, so can you just tell us why you're not allowed to record things in court? Because, I mean, surely the whole point of a court case is that justice is seen to be done, and the idea that it's recorded actually is quite important. You've got a stenographer, haven't you, recording everything that's going on?
Well, Maurice will tell you a bit more exactly who's doing what in courts, because he's been in and out of all sorts of more courts than I have. But I have gathered all of the comments lately that signers of the petition put together. And everybody suggests, well, if that not justice, exactly as you said, shouldn't just seem to be done, it should also be heard to be done. Therefore, it should be recorded. They don't have anything to hide. I spoke to a solicitor today who said, well, there could be something private. But then I said, well, they always retire to their chambers anyway. So I don't know on what grounds this act was produced when it was made illegal, but it certainly is not in tune with the 21st century, where anybody can record anything anywhere.
What about retiring to their chambers? What's that about? Because isn't that when the judges disappear off and have a sort of quiet chit-chat with maybe barristers, or who do they talk to?
Well, yeah, I guess that's the purpose. I mean, it has just been suggested to me that there may be things that are private and therefore they shouldn't be recorded, but that doesn't seem to be a reason for just putting somebody into prison when they actually do record, especially when people are maybe hard of hearing and are not given the chance to ask for permission, which they expect to do. I mean, that was the case with Norman Scarfe, who stood up to ask for permission, but the judge shouted him down before he could ever get the permission, and he ended up in prison.
Now, this is an issue for many, many journalists, and certainly at the national press, national papers, often they find themselves covering a case only to be told that, I'm afraid, that there are reporting restrictions, and if you report this, you will go to jail for up to 10 years. Now, again, that also doesn't sound like justice being seen to be done.
No, exactly, and that is actually at its worst in the family courts, where I assisted in this terrible case where the judge, which was in a criminal court, said he was following the directives of his senior colleague in the family court and therefore didn't even allow the people in the public gallery to take notes, and only professional journalists could then sort of produce their cards and were allowed to take notes. But it seems completely against the idea of justice and certainly the practice of justice.
Now, I like what you say about dragging the courts into the 21st century. We also had a lot of discussion in the 1980s and 90s about the possibility of televising and putting on the radio the House of Commons. At the time, many people said that could never be done. It's a terrible idea. Now, of course, we're quite used to having that happen every Wednesday for Prime Minister's Questions. And, of course, there's a whole channel of BBC Parliament devoted to that, and of course all of the committee proceedings.
Yeah, I haven't watched how much is happening, and in terms of the courts, they do want to broadcast, but only the summaries. But I think it is only too true to say that if you read George Monbiot today, he said you can only understand who governs us if you understand how the elite is being brought up, and that they just are completely out of touch. And therefore, I sent the comments of these petition signers now to the Lord Chief Justice, who actually took the hearing of Norman Scott in his absence. And I hope that this way he'll get a bit more in touch with what people are actually experiencing, how transcripts are either not available or get lost, or recordings are tampered with. And I have quite a few victims who are really directly affected, where clearly judges are covering up, where court staff are aiding in covering up. And in that particular case that I was referring to, the bank company went bankrupt, and so the transcripts can't be had. I mean, it is just really more of a shambles than the working system. From my biased perspective, I must admit. Of course, I don't have statistics of cases that work. I only have cases that don't work.
Okay, tell us a bit about Norman Scarth and his case then.
Well, Norman is sort of like Maurice, one of those guys who's been at it for donkey's years, 17 to be precise. And I will forever say that no matter what an individual may have done, the system has always been worse. Norman has an accumulation of cases like Maurice, and it leaves behind what I call, or some Americans call, the legal abuse syndrome. That particular case where we attended last week on Wednesday was about the fact that he was supposedly recording in court, and the result was that he was sentenced in his absence to 28 days imprisonment, but it was suspended for a year. So if he doesn't commit another crime, he won't have to go to prison. But of course, he doesn't feel safe. He's in Ireland. He went to Ireland to be safe, because he, just like Maurice, knows by now they will try and do anything to get him behind bars and actually into a mental hospital. That's the worst thing that is the practice.
So what's the nub of the issue, though? What is Norman Scarth actually fighting for?
Well, in that particular case, the fact was he stood up to ask for permission, was shouted down by the judge, so couldn't ask for permission, and then I'm not 100% sure whether he'd actually did use or didn't use a recording device, but he was there as a Mackenzie friend to help somebody else. He is hard of hearing himself, so he wanted to get something recorded, and he may very well have recorded and didn't get the permission. And so now the Lord Chief Justice, of course, in his magnanimousness at least, said, well, if ever he does ask for permission, it will be granted, whether he is himself a victim or whether he will act as a Mackenzie friend, and especially because he has so much distrust in the system. But it's all a farce, really, because subsequently what became apparent was that the barrister who read the affidavit out of the Attorney General, who is in that case actually the claimant, that same affidavit was used by somebody else. Now, how can that be? Well, now, neither of the guys were present in any case, so they just invent words on paper, and it all looks and sounds official, and they think they can get away with it. I mean, this is my version of rough justice interpretation.
I'm just introducing Maurice Kirk now. Maurice?
I'm very tired because I've been fighting in the family courts all day. But I'd like to play devil's advocate on one or two issues, on the law of contempt of court and using a tape recorder. I have always been extremely strongly opposed to people taking recordings, and I've voiced that for the last 20 years in big places. And my views are changing because I have spent over £20,000 in buying transcripts over the years. And the standard of transcripts in South Wales has become quite appalling. Now, they are using, due to the European situation, a lot more foreign people doing the transcripts. And it's crucial points where they say inaudible, just the bit that you want to hear. Now you should not be allowed to tape record in a court, because it can pick up private conversations between people within the well of the court. And I will back anybody who convicts someone who has done it in certain circumstances. I was in court testing all this today, and I took Jeff with me today, who Sabine knows, to witness the way that I laid it into the judge politely about breaking down the argument that we cannot have our own tape recording. You must not muddle up with having a tape recording you surreptitiously take a clandestine manner. You should be allowed to put your own tape recorder on the front of the desk and have the case taped. It is quite outrageous. When I was in Guernsey, even Guernsey in a magistrate's court, you had the transcript and you had it free. I think now you have to pay for it, but at least at summary level of courts, even in an archaic and wicked area of a tax haven, they allow that. That is what needs to be introduced into the magistrates' courts of England and Wales immediately. Now, I have been putting up on my website, kirkflyingvet.com, tape recordings from magistrates. Now, I know a number of people who, because of their deafness, because they cannot write very well, and for other reasons, they have decided to tape record for their own use with no intention of picking up other people. But I'm now openly publishing the tape recordings of my case that is before the Criminal Court of Appeal. I have a series of tape recordings that were taken in Cardiff Magistrates to show the wickedness that Sabine has been trying to put over in her conversation. I've actually witnessed 20 years of it, and the standard in our law courts now is getting worse and worse, mainly because the lawyers, whether they be solicitors or barristers, are no longer accountable to what they were like back when I was a student.
Now, hang on, Maurice, because surely what you're doing there is you're presenting online to the public open evidence of contempt of court.
I am doing it on purpose because under the Harassment Act, Section 13A and C, for which I've served 9 months imprisonment under a section above that, of harassing a police doctor who says that I have a brain tumour and significant brain damage and I should be locked away for life. I have, under the Act, you cannot be done for harassment if you can show that you are in pursuit, it was in the Telegraph this week I noticed, in the pursuit of detecting crime or preventing crime. Now, who is saying that my tape recordings were not allowed? You asked the judge, and this is what we set up this morning. Well, Jeff didn't know what I'm doing because I didn't want anybody to know in advance because I'm under serious surveillance 24/7. And I asked...
Well, you're under surveillance by us now. We're listening
yes,
to you.
Yes, but the judge... I asked the judge, may I tape record these recordings, this hearing? And he said, no, you can pay the transcript. And I said, no, the transcript is no longer safe. That is what I'm... That is why I've changed my view now. That, well, I've never changed my view that you should not secretly tape record. You should not be allowed to tape record. You should be allowed to openly tape record, but under the control of the clerk of the court, so that you do not pick up personal conversations in the well.
Now, before we say goodbye to Sabine on the line, Sabine, I noticed also on the blog, this is a week or so ago, you've got a thing about the Queen and the Bank of England. Talking about writing to the Queen, is there really any point in that about the way the banking system operates?
Well, the only reason I've done it is because I kind of want to have done it, and the responses are always prompt from Buckingham Palace, but they are fob-offs to other ministers, and of course the ministers then don't act.
So what could the Queen do with the Bank of England? Does she have much to do with the bank?
Well, she only visited Mervyn King once, actually, and I think the tragedy is, I really imagine she doesn't know what's going on.
Do you know if she's been texting him and chatting to him on the mobile?
No, I mean, I can't remember when it was that she only went to see him once, that one time, but you remember she asked at the LSE why didn't anybody saw the crisis coming, and I wonder whether she knew that the Royal Mint was privatised. I mean, there are things that are going on that I call the civil abuse of royal privileges, and therefore I felt I needed to write. And now there are people who write to the Prime Minister about treason, and we just have to try, that's all, even though it may not do anything, but at least it's sort of for the record on the web at least.
Okay, that's lovely. Sabine McNeil from victims-unite.net, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
Now, Maurice, you've been in court today, I understand, haven't you? What's that all about?
Well, yes, I've got a couple of busy days. I've been in the family court today, and it's due to carry on tomorrow. And they've cleverly, the South Wales Police and the what I call the Cardiff Cabal, have arranged for my big three-month trial that starts on the 18th of February to have a preliminary hearing tomorrow. And they think I'm not going to turn up to one of the cases. They're pretending it was a mistake. But
well, how do you know that they think you're not going to turn up?
Well, they know that I can't be at both cases at once. And because they both relate to trying to get me bankrupt, the only way they're going to stop the trial, this is where 100 police officers have to be cross-examined by me, this is a very big case in Wales, which is why it's has no publicity at all, and it will cover no publicity. It's only websites that will cover it. They were trying to stop me to go. I'm making applications tomorrow for the defendant in my action to be called as a witness. Now, that might surprise you, but I'm suing the South Wales Police, and they've already indicated that I'm not allowed to call the senior police officers who instigated my imprisonments over the last 20 years.
So that's going to start when, and how long do you think it's going to run for?
Oh, it'll run for 3 months. It's starting on the 18th of February. But tomorrow is the issue where I'm now applying for witness summonses for about 60, some of them retired police officers, and they are going to be my witnesses. So, of course, it'll be very dangerous. It'll be a lot of fun because you can't lead your own witnesses. But they're retired police officers, and I'm hoping that truth will out.
And what's the basis of trying to get these people to court? What's the point?
To produce proof of the truth of what has occurred in some 60 or 7 police incidents where I've been accused of motoring offences, all sorts of things. And they're determined that this trial doesn't start. For the last 20 years, they've managed to block it on 4 occasions by arresting me just before the trial starts. Now, this week, they've done it again. I went over to Brittany to collect 100 lever arch files, which is part of the case. So sensitive, they have to be kept outside of the UK. And we were having lunch, and I spoke to the lawyers for the police and the rogue doctor who says I have significant brain damage and a brain tumour. And within 30 minutes, we were walking down the street, and I was surrounded by gendarmes. They were running at me from all directions. I counted 4, and I think there were 5. And they bundled me into the police station. And fortunately, I had a chap from Cardiff with me, and he dog-trotted afterwards up to the station, and he heard them saying that they were going to put me in an asylum. Well, this is the same game that they tried with the machine gun case, and then they said that
For people that didn't hear that the first time, Maurice, the machine gun case is where you had a rusty old aircraft machine gun that didn't actually fire, and then you were accused of being a lethal weapon, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I was a display pilot at Farnborough, and this was an old World War One, on an old biplane, Lewis machine gun, and I'd sold it a year earlier, but they used it as an excuse to block this big civil action 3 years ago, and I was locked up for 8 months. Before the trial, which I won, and when they knew I was going to win it, they then sectioned me under the Mental Health Act and tried to get me sent to Broadmoor. But this is exactly what's just happened in France. And of course, I told Sabine and a lot of other people that you wait, I'm going to be arrested leading up to the weeks before the trial. And they sent me down to Pontivy. They took me down to Pontivy Hospital, 30 miles. And when I realised, I guessed that it was sectioning. So I closed my eyes, didn't move, wouldn't speak. So they had to carry me all around, wouldn't walk. So they carried me all around the hospital, 3 burly policemen. And then they put me in a wheelchair. And then the doctors surrounded me because I could see, because I was quietly looking at the floor, seeing more and more feet in Crocs around me. And then one of the girls said, one of the nurses said, "Oh, c'est Maurice, c'est le vétérinaire volant, the flying vet. He, surely, yes. What he came here to have his new hip 2 years ago. I'm sure it's Maurice." And she said, "Well, what's he in here for?" "Oh, he's being sectioned. We're sending him to an asylum." "Section? What for?" "Oh, he's mentally ill." And she laughed, and everybody laughed. And they said, "Well,
he had his operation. He turned up on his crutches and his suitcase being carried by a pretty nurse, and he demanded to be able to fish out of the window with his fishing rod, because the River Blavet was right underneath the window. And after the operation, far too quickly, he sneaked out on a Sunday in the rain in his pyjamas and a raincoat, and thumbed down a taxi on his crutches and went off to the races. There's nothing wrong with him. So they had to give up trying to section me, but they locked me up for the night. They took me back to the police station.
Now, if people want to follow this case in Cardiff, where is it taking place and how do people do it? Because I imagine it's open to the public, a public gallery.
Yes, it's the Cardiff Civil Justice Centre, near the railway station, right beside the bus station. The details will be on websites, mine, the two main websites, kirkflyingvet.com and morrisjohnkirk at wordpress.com. It's going to be a farce because I'm not going to be allowed to have the witnesses that I need, like the chief constable, who is the defendant. They aren't calling him because she set up my MAPA registration of MAPA level 3 most dangerous, saying because I have a brain tumour and therefore should be locked away and therefore we can't have a court case. They'll come up with another trick between now and the 15th of February.
Well, we'll see, and hopefully have you back in a few weeks' time to report back, Morris. Thank you very much. Right, well, I'm joined by Commander John Muxworthy. John, you're... should I call you Commander or should I call you John? You're retired, so probably John, isn't it?
It is after this length of time. John Muxworthy and I started the United Kingdom National Defence Association.
John, can you tell us something about your role in the Royal Navy?
32 years, started at Dartmouth, had a wonderful time there, and then the next 28, 29 years were travelling around in anything from 15 different ships to shore establishments, so I can claim to have been there, seen it and done it.
Can you tell us what ships you were actually in command of? And were you actually a captain?
No, I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh. I'm a commander by rank, and I was a part of the Navy is broken up into seamanship, engineers, supply and secretariat, and so forth. And I was a commander S&S, supply and secretariat, which got me very irritated when I first started because my eyesight wasn't quite up to standard and I didn't have much choice. Having said that, as a supply officer, I spent more time at sea than I did ashore and had a damn good career.
What sort of things were you actually doing then? Making sure that the ships had enough food and ammunition, this kind of thing?
Yes, it's all 50-50 because whatever one's specialism, electrician, engineer, seaman or supply officer, there's always the operational side. So whenever I was serving in a frigate, I was usually the flight deck officer, which was operational, controlling the takeoff and landing of the helicopters, which was, I won't say great fun, but it was greatly interesting, particularly when the weather was rough. So you get a complete cross-section when you're in the military. You're never just the one person doing one thing. You do probably a dozen different things. And as I say, I was cross in the very early days when I thought, oh, I'm just going to be a pusser. And I don't mean a purser. A pusser is the Navy name for supply and secretariat. But I genuinely spent two-thirds of my time operational. And I won't say I enjoyed every moment of it because I went through the Falklands. But I enjoyed my service and I would do it again tomorrow.
Now, we've heard quite a lot about the Falklands recently. I mean, there's all sorts of questions over whether the oil and natural resources around that are actually Britain's or Argentina's. But tell us a bit about your role in the Falklands.
Well, I just finished an appointment. An appointment is a job. We do it every 2 years and then we tend to move around. And I was on leave, just about to go back to a new job, when suddenly, and this is back in 1982, when suddenly on the radio was an announcement on the news that the Argentine army had invaded the Falkland Islands. And as I was on leave, I knew that something would happen. I didn't know what. So I rang up my boss in the Admiralty and said, look, are you looking for any supply officers? And he said, where are you? And I said, well, I'm in Southampton. He said, right, you are now the Royal Navy supply officer for this SS Canberra. I said, I beg your pardon. And in fact, nobody had appreciated that we would be taking, as we say, ships up from trade, which was Canberra, and we used her as a passenger for the Royal Marine Commandos and the paratroopers, and I ended up going down as the Royal Naval Supply and Assistant on all of that area, because there were about 3,000 troops, and the Navy was coordinating with P&O, who obviously owned Canberra. Now, it was exciting, it was terrifying, it was boring, but it was a mini war, and the Royal Navy did a wonderful job. Without it, we would have lost the Falklands. We nearly did, to be honest, because we were out there for 7 or 8 weeks, and by the end of it, we were exhausted, the ships were exhausted, the fuel was exhausted, the ammunition was running down, and if Galtieri, General Galtieri, had persevered for one more week, I think we would have all been turning around and going back, because we were shattered. But we didn't, and we broke them, and you know the answer. Now, it keeps on coming back to say, could we do it again if the Argentines attacked and invaded the Falklands? Now, bluntly, and we've talked to the Ministry of Defence about this, it's unlikely, because we really did break them down, and this is 30 years ago. They still have some good troops, but they don't have nearly so many aircraft, and they don't have nearly so many ships. But because we now have so few ships, if the Argentines by any chance manage to get in there and mess up the aerodrome, which is the one we built, if that was messed up, we would have no way whatsoever in reinforcing the Falklands, and we would lose it. We, incidentally, the UK and NDA has just written a paper on this about 3 or 4 months ago, which, as we always do now, we send to the Prime Minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and all the service chiefs. So it's unlikely, but it's the sort of thing that the armed forces are there to do. If something crops up, they need to deal with it immediately. And the way this government and its predecessor is cutting down on the armed forces, we would not now be able to repel an attack on the Falklands, because in those days, 1982, there were 100 ships involved. Now we couldn't do half a dozen. It's as bad as that.
Okay, well, give us the numbers. What, I mean, in terms of, you know, the sort of major types of ship, I suppose we're talking here about things like cruisers and aircraft carriers, frigates. I mean, how does it compare now with the 1980s?
We are emasculated. That's the word I use these days. We are shrunken beyond anything that's sensible. In the Falklands, we had 2 aircraft carriers, thank goodness, Hermes and Invincible. But we damn nearly lost those, because just a month or so before the Falklands broke, the Secretary of State for Defence, who was a banker, as it happens...
You mean John Knott. 1985, he became chairman and chief executive of the banking firm Lazard Brothers, now lives on his farm at St. Erith in Cornwall.
He was a banker who was the Secretary of State for Defence, and he was busy negotiating to sell our 2 remaining small aircraft carriers to the Australians. Thank goodness. And there's a very interesting story here, if you've got just a moment for it, because when the Falklands crisis broke, it was a surprise. All right, there'd been some warnings, but nobody in government took any notice of them. And when it suddenly happened, it was a disaster. And the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, for whom I have the greatest respect, but Margaret Thatcher called a cabinet minister together and said, what can we do? Now, all of the military, all of the Ministry of Defence, rather, and the people there, and the politicians were saying, Prime Minister, we cannot manage this, we cannot do it. Fortunately for us and for the Falklands, Admiral Leach, who was the first Sea Lord, happened to be in London, happened to be in uniform, which in those days was unusual because of the IRA threat. He'd been on a formal visit, was in London in uniform, and he dashed across to Downing Street, demanded to see the Prime Minister, who was delighted to see him, because everyone was telling her how desperate and how difficult it was going to be. She turned to him and said, Admiral, First Sea Lord, can we take the Falklands? Can we retake the Falklands? And he said, ma'am, we not only can, we must, because if we do not do this, the entire country's respect, the country's position in the world will be absolutely ruined, but we can do it. Give me the orders and I will do it. and she was so relieved that there was somebody with guts. And fortuitously, there had been, and don't forget, we still had about 100 ships that we could use. At that time, there'd been a big naval exercise, and it was in Gibraltar, and all people for a big operation. And all the ships were ready, and fortuitously, she said, send them to the Falklands. And 9 or 10 or 11 weeks further on, we managed it. But it was a very close-run thing, and that was with 100 ships. We couldn't do it now.
So give me the numbers. How many ships do we have now?
Well, the major thing, even Queen Elizabeth I used to say that if I lost ships, it would be carved on my heart, give me frigates. And so did Nelson. I think it might have been Nelson. I'm exaggerating. But that's the cry. Frigates and destroyers are the mechanism by which the Navy runs. All right, hopefully you've got some aircraft carriers. But if you don't have frigates and destroyers who can go around, they're slightly cheaper. You need more of them, but they can go and protect the sea lanes of the world. In those days, we had almost, together with the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, which are full of tankers and supply ships, we had that number of ships. Now we are down, instead of the 60 frigates and destroyers we had in 1982, we have 19. This brings me into the two big defense reviews. In 1998 was the last really big defense review. In other words, the politicians saying, let's look at the Navy, let's look at the Army, let's look at the RAF. What do we really need to do to maintain our position in the world? And as far as the Navy was concerned, it was decided that the minimum numbers we could do with frigates and destroyers was 32. And everybody agreed it took 2 years because it was done very, very thoroughly. And it was government policy from then on we would have at least 32 frigates and destroyers. We've now got 19. It wasn't just the Tories who did this. Before that, the Labour government started to cut away and say, oh, we can't afford it. But now we're down to 19, and it's not enough, because at any one time, if you want to ship in, say, Gibraltar, you need three, because one ship will be almost certainly in repair and modernization, one ship will be retraining, having come back from operations, and there'll be one available on site. In other words, to get one ship where you want it, you need three in total. Yeah, so out of the 19, at any one time, we'd be very fortunate to be able to have operational more than about 8 or 9. Now, and that is for a Royal Navy that used to have hundreds of ships.
Now, what about the aircraft carriers, though? Because there's been a famous episode, really, with our Royal being taken out of service, and we now apparently have no aircraft carriers. I mean, some would say that the age of these kind of big ships is over, that the kind of missiles that are around today can take these ships out, so there's almost no point in having them.
I'm sorry if I laugh, because, yes, of course, that's the instinctive thing to say. Aircraft carriers have been, over the last 50 to 70 years, the mainstream of the attack force of the Royal Navy, or indeed any navy. The Americans see fit to keep 12 very large aircraft carriers going all the time. We got down to 3, then we got down to 2, that was Invincible and Ark Royal, and for some complete, well, I know exactly why, because the government was desperately trying to save money, and for some unbelievable reason, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer were, I would almost say, bullied into agreeing that, well, cast aside Ark Royal. And that was crazy, because now we have there is one aircraft carrier still going, but that's one that's only capable of carrying helicopters, because all of our fixed-wing aircraft have been thrown away, and that is the Sea Harrier. The Harriers were brilliant. Even the RAF version, which was slightly different, were brilliant. And then at a stroke, to save money, and it was done in one day, believe me, there was a decision. The Prime Minister was buttonholed on a Saturday weekend just before the final results of this big review were going on, and he was talked into cancelling Ark Royal and having her withdrawn from service. That meant that the 65 Harriers had to be got rid of, the RAF ones and the Navy ones, and they were sold to the US Marine Corps, who operate the Harriers as well, they were delighted because they only had to pay £1 million an aircraft. Do you know what the cost of the Harrier was? £32 million. So for anyone who tries to tell me that this is saving money, it's madness.
The other thing, of course, was that those Harriers had only just been refurbished.
Correct.
At the cost of billions of pounds.
I lifted my hat every time I saw a Harrier, because when I was in the Falklands, whenever we saw Harriers flying, we knew we were as safe as we could possibly be. And even then, we only had 8 or 9 flying off our one carrier. We had 2, Hermes and Invincible. Hermes was the old conventional carrier, which was brilliant, and she in fact then, although we sold her off eventually, she went on to be the flagship of the Indian Navy for about another 20 years. So with the big ships, we could, if we'd wish, kept them going. But now we've only got one. She can only operate helicopters, and therefore the area of action whereby helicopters can cover 200 or 300 miles, and that's pushing it. For fixed-wing aircraft, which we do not have anymore for carriers, at least not for another 6 years, you could go for 1,000 miles.
And now, let's just get these. Let me just get these.
Weaken this the strike capability of the Royal Navy.
Absolutely, but I mean, let's just get these figures right. The price for the Harriers, there were 74 of them, was 112 million. So that we did get a little bit more than £1 million each for them.
Well, but even so, whatever the specific figures, we were seen off.
But
well,
the refit,
we were prepared to give it to the Marines because they are our greatest ally, or perhaps it's the other way around, and it was at least good to see them being used. But by gum, to emasculate the Royal Navy and take away its major strike capability was a weak and foolish move, and that's the least I can say about it.
Well, I mean, it's five. I mean, we just spent 5 times more than that amount of money
got
on the refit. So
exactly.
This does seem incredible. I mean, it almost seems, John, as if Britain is being disarmed.
That's exactly. Funny you should say that. The UK NDA is doing its desperate best, and we've been doing it for 5 years now, to talk to the Prime Minister and the Chancellor and all of the Chiefs of Staff and talk to them objectively, and we write reports. We've written 14 reports and submitted them to the Prime Minister, and the last one that we wrote, there were two, in fact. One was all about we need a proper national defence review, because the last one was just to save money. It had nothing whatsoever to do with the strategic need of the country. And may I actually take one sidestep on this, because the finances of this are crucial. The Navy keeps on having its strength cut and its money taken away. Now, at the end of the Second World War, we had 63% of all the country's resources, gross national product, went towards the war. Now, you can understand that's reasonable. Of course, as soon as the war was over, there were hundreds, if not more, ships and thousands and millions of men, and they had to be got rid of. By the time the next war came along in Korea, instead of 60% going on GDP, it had come down to 10%, still quite a lot. By the time we got to, and that meant the Navy was shrunk and the Army was shrunk and the RAF was shrunk, still understandable. By the time we got to the Falklands, the amount spent on the Navy, Army and Air Force was down to 5%. Now, as I'm standing here today, it's less than 2%. And yet, the Chancellor is saying all of the big departments must give, in this time of austerity, the same amount. Everybody's got to be treated as equals. Now, that is the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard, because whilst the armed forces were being cut year after year after year, as I've just told you, from 60% down to 2%, the large other budgets like health and welfare and education and transport, but health and welfare in particular, and I'm not begrudging it, but their income was going up fivefold every time. And so whilst they're getting massive improvements, and I think that was important, the amount that the armed forces have been cut has gone beyond anything reasonable, and yet we're still being cut, and that is another mistake. So with all these reports, We're trying to get the truth back to the Prime Minister because they're doing it again.
Yes, well, I mean, you've just said that, and the soldier numbers are going to be slashed to the lowest level, as you said earlier, since Napoleon, and a further 5,300 are going to lose their jobs in the armed forces. It must be rather galling for some people maybe to have finished a tour of duty somewhere abroad and then to be told, well, sorry, you're going to be signing on.
Oh, absolutely. It's not just appalling, it's disastrous. I joined the Royal Navy in 1960, and I didn't even cross my mind I was going to be there for a whole career, and fortunately I did. I spent 32 years, and some people spend even more than that. Now, it's desperately difficult to get a full-time career, and the people who are being thrown out are devastated, and therefore morale is dropping. The only place where morale is good is when you're on operations. So the people who are still in Afghanistan, for example, and they're going to be starting withdrawn soon, but whilst it's no fun, their morale is good because they are on operations, which is what people join the military to do, to defend their country and help whenever they can. But now, when you are then cast aside, it's disastrous, and there are a lot of mature people in their mid-career who are very experienced. Some are even volunteering to go, but not enough, and so people are forcefully... The whole thing is a disaster.
Now, is there any real critique from military people about the banking system? Because the arguments that's being used to saying that the military needs to be cut now is really a financial and an economics one. And my question to you is, do military people have an economic understanding that would maybe send ships up the Thames to the Bank of England to tell them to get their act together and to start getting economically literate?
Yes, and firing a broadside. No, you're absolutely right, but there isn't a good understanding of how weak the armed forces are becoming, and it's such false economy that you couldn't possibly believe it. As I've already said, this has been a cut after cut after cut after cut, whilst all the other departments have been going up and up in their finances. Now, we know that we're facing difficult times, but the number of times the Prime Minister has said, and it is famous for saying it, is that defence is the first priority of any government. So why on earth are we about number 9 in the pecking order, having had most of our money and finances and all our resources withdrawn, whilst everybody else, yes, they're being cut, but we have been cut far beyond anything that's reasonable.
I wonder,
flexibility left.
I mean, most of the big decisions in the world of finance don't take place in London. They take place at, for example, last weekend, there's a big meeting in Switzerland at Davos of all of the richest and most powerful people across the Western world. And surely this is where people like yourself need to be looking if you're going to demand that the financial crisis, the debt spiral, is sorted out, and that some money is then available for healthcare, to start the economy going again, and of course for the military.
Of course, you're absolutely right, but it is a question of priorities, and we are so low now in the priority list, it's gone beyond what is acceptable. Because in the end, if defence fails, if this country and its interests, and we're not just talking about people charging over the beaches and trying to attack the country, it's not that. This is a maritime nation. 95% of everything that we sell, do or buy comes and goes by sea. And we've got a handful, and I mean a handful, of trying to protect them. I could spend a long time talking about why we need a good army, a sufficient RAF. The RAF, for example, we haven't mentioned them. Up until 20 years ago, there were 90,000 people in the RAF. Now there are 30,000, and still being cut, as indeed is the Navy. There were in those days 30 squadrons of fast jets. There are now 11. And that's the same sort of priorities that the Navy has been suffering from. The trouble is, once you have got rid of a carrier or a frigate or a destroyer, it can take 10 to 15 years to build another one. And Ark Royal was a good example. There was no reason whatsoever to cast her aside at that time. Although she was getting old, she was still very viable. And she's sitting rotting in Portsmouth Harbour at the moment whilst they decide how to sell her.
And your website again, just remind us,
uknda.org.
Now, time to our weekly chit-chat with Jason Yiannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hello, Tony.
Jason, you brought a copy of the latest Private Eye along, haven't you?
Yes, there's some very interesting stories in this edition. Here's one I think will benefit you. John Leon, who was the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards presiding over the worst era of fiddling in the history of the Commons, is stepping down.
So what does the Standards Commissioner do? The idea is that if you think that some MP is somehow cheating in whatever way, you can write to them and they'll do something about it. Is that the idea?
Well, yes, that's the idea. I mean,
and the idea is that he didn't.
Well, yes, it's not just that, but it's very interesting because it all comes under the parliamentary thing, so he has to look after payments and stuff like that as well.
So what's happening? He's just retiring, is he?
He's just retiring, but the most interesting thing is something that's come up. It is suggested, well, in fact, it's not even suggested, he has opened an inquest into Maria Miller MP, who is the Secretary of State for Culture.
Okay, so what's that about? What's she been up to?
She's claimed £90,000 over 4 years for a house she already owned where her previous parents lived, and she was claiming this on expenses.
Hang on a minute, you're not supposed to do that.
No, that is completely.
And this is the person who's in charge of the entire culture of the country.
Yeah, it's called Comedians Sports Secretary.
It's taken over from Jeremy Hunt, the guy who was very friendly with Rupert Murdoch.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Tell you what, Michael Crick was tweeting about Murdoch.
Really?
Today, yes, or this week, anyway. He's saying that Rupert Murdoch was so friendly with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that when Netanyahu came to London, he stayed in Murdoch's flat.
No.
So that's quite friendly, isn't it?
That's shocking, actually. I never knew that.
Well, there you go. That's Michael Crick. Now, Michael Crick, I think I would say excellent journalist, couldn't quite cope with Newsnight. I mean, he left Newsnight in 2012 because he was finding that his interviews he was doing with top politicians were being edited, and also he was putting them on the BBC archive massive hard drive and then finding that people were deleting them off the hard drive. When he complained internally in the BBC saying don't delete these important historic interviews off of the BBC archives, he was told, oh, that's our policy because we're saving disk space.
I think more saving their bags.
Well, and also, yes, it means that the other journalists in the future at the BBC and the public haven't got records of what these people are actually saying.
It's funny. I wonder if you can still find records of Rough Justice thing, as we mentioned that a couple of times.
Well, possibly. In the BBC archive, or they certainly they don't re-show these, don't they? But they seem to do is as for repeats. They always have the sort of crummy programmes that they repeat. The really interesting ones, like the BBC Time Watch from 1992 with Alan Frankovich, the three-part series he made about Gladio, where NATO were going around Europe blowing people up and blaming it on the Russians. They haven't repeated that for some reason. Although it is in the archive. We'd actually had a BBC person check to see that it is actually in the archive, and it is
there. That's amazing.
And he watched it, but it hasn't been transmitted since 1992. I suppose it's because it's the wrong story. Anyway, talking of stories... Private Eye again.
Well, yes, actually, there's another very good story in there, being as you did mention the Murdochs. You're going to absolutely love this one, Tony. George Osborne had, I think it was a lunch. I've got to look this, yes. He had, George Osborne recently had a meeting, certainly, with a man named Robert Thompson, who's the outgoing editor of the Wall Street Journal, but more than that, he has just been named as the chief executive of the new company that will control all of Murdoch's interests in Britain.
Oh. Yeah. So, all Murdoch's interests?
Pretty much. There's control of... okay, it says Murdoch... No, sorry, I do apologise. That is Murdoch's newspaper operations in Britain and the US. It's interesting because... Because he was accused of schmoozing by the Leveson inquiry, and here he is again talking to a senior man who will be controlling the Murdoch newspapers.
Gosh, it doesn't end this, does it? I mean,
it really doesn't.
You do wonder if really it's the Murdoch that is running things rather than the government.
It probably has been for a while. It's certainly been run by almost like a cabal, if you will, of high-ranking bankers and newspaper owners and top businessman. I mean, this brings up to Bilderberg this Group, really, isn't it?
This is where Private Eye comes in quite handy, though, isn't it? Because what they're quite good at is pointing out exactly who it is that's having lunches with and having deals with. I mean, there's been some various bits and pieces on Twitter this week about lunches Murdoch's been having with various people and people from the Murdoch Empire, Osborne and Cameron, basically. And it's not appropriate, I would say, whilst this whole Leveson thing is going on, for this to be happening, because what's happened essentially, it's a bit like the Chilcot inquiry, isn't it, into the Iraq war, Jason, that, you know, you've had a massive inquiry into it, but actually nothing's happened. The same exact thing with Leveson.
Well, yeah, it's the thing. They call these inquiries to find out the truth about something or other. The inquiry then does what it's asked to. It comes out with a conclusion and a set of things that are supposed to be done, and then they just ignore it. to be put bluntly, they just ignore it. There's another piece on the Murdoch thing here. Is that there might be a little trouble within some of the Murdoch papers here. I don't know if you know this, but the Times has a series of independent national directors who usually rubber stamp Rupert Murdoch's choice of successor.
Uh-huh.
But this time they've decided not to.
No, I don't believe it.
Yeah, they've actually gone against Murdoch.
Hang on a minute. Isn't that like biting the hand that feeds you?
It is. It's they refused to recognise the mandate who was the Sunday Times editor, who John Witherow, here we are, the man who was the editor of Sunday Times. They refused to appoint him as editor of the Times. And how has Murdoch responded to this? Murdoch has given him the role of acting editor.
What do you think about Gerald Scarfe, the cartoon he's done this week on Holocaust Memorial Day, apparently showing Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister who's just been re-elected in well, at least we think he probably has, because they're still doing all the sort of deals post the Israeli elections, shows Netanyahu building a wall, I mean, obviously the Palestinian wall, a bit like the Berlin Wall in Palestine, using the bodies of dead Palestinians. That's a little bit of an embarrassing one. He's had to say sorry for that.
Yeah, that wasn't advisable. He may have been making a political point, but I think particularly in terms of putting the choice of the day, that was probably not very well thought out.
Yes, well, no wonder there's an apology for that.
Yeah.
Okay, Jason, anything else?
Not really, other than to talk about the maybe if we could mention the Panorama.
Oh, that's right. Monday evening. Yes.
Monday evening. Yeah.
Panorama was about I think it's about the work program mainly, and about the sort of privatisation of the job centres in a way. That's essentially what this is, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's all about the parking the applicants, you know, so they can cherry pick the best ones out, which is technically against the law. It's technically against you in the UK. It's not supposed to be done, of course. The applicants, a lot of people with disabilities, people, a lot of them in similar situations to a few of my friends back in the National Autistic Society. Finding themselves being called lying, thieving bastards, and to be honest, I think triage have got a nerve to be calling other people lying, thieving bastards.
Triage is an awful name for a place as well. It's almost like some sort of wound. When you're triaging a wound, you're you know, it's basically an injured person, isn't it? Very inappropriate name, I think, for a business that's trying to help unemployed people get into work. It's almost like,
well, if it is trying to help unemployed people getting into work,
if it actually is, yeah. The other side of it, of course, also is that you've got a very bad economic climate for jobs at the moment, with the economy flatlining and people being sacked from the public sector and no real increase in the private sector. So, you know, I think if you're looking at the way the economy's going, surely it's just heading in the sort of direction of Greece or Spain.
Well, yes, you see, this is the problem. I mean, some people suggest it's a good thing to have a chancellor that doesn't have any qualifications in economics. But, you know, it's for those interested, George Osborne's qualification is a 2-1 in modern history.
Well, at least maybe he... I mean, does that modern history include the 1929 crash?
I'm not entirely sure.
I hope so.
It doesn't look like it, does it?
Maybe it starts in the Second World War or something, and that's why he doesn't really quite understand economics.
Well, it's we've gotten to
Iceland does though, doesn't it? That's another bit of news this week. The Icelandic government's been completely exonerated in the way it dealt with its bankers by arresting them and jailing them, and also by saying to the IMF and the big banks around Europe, basically sticking two fingers up at them and saying, "Okay, we're not paying those debts." And they've now been patted on the back and said, "You did the right thing." So maybe we should send Osborne to Iceland, Reykjavik.
Well, he certainly will make a wreck
for
of
a
it,
little.
You know.
Great way to end. All right, thanks very much, Jason. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. And I will be bringing you the BCFM Politics Show on Friday drive time. That's every Friday from 5 to 7, a few hours later. That's live. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to emails reminding you of Dialect programmes. Just go to our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect's a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And as promised, here's the number again, which we do each week for the Bristol Bully Watch Helpline. That's 01454 318 753. 01454 318 753, mainly for parents and their children at school. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
Deep inside, frightened of